I want to jump in and talk about Dickey really quick, because I think you hit on something that's extremely important. The knuckleball velocity is a big deal. When he's been just average, his knuckleball has been in this, 75, 76 mile an hour range. Back in 2012, it was consistently around 78 miles per hour. The last couple months, pretty much since the All-Star break, he's been at about 78 miles per hour again, and it's not coincidental that his performance is lined up with it. Welcome to episode 67 of Flies Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Ginella and George Bissell. How are you guys doing on this Thursday night? It's a different night. We don't usually record on Thursdays. This is different.
Why did we have to record Thursday? If it's none of my business, you can tell me that. But yeah, why did we get bumped back?
We got bumped back because we recorded Tino last night.
Okay.
It's a lot harder to coordinate four people's schedules than three people's schedules.
Did that get bumped back, or was that just...
We did Tino last night because Craig and Mal forgot we were supposed to do Tino the Wednesday before.
Yeah, this is that weird time of year where we're kind of running out of stuff to talk about. So I don't know if it's different on Tino, but I know here we're kind of reaching that end point of the season where, if you're not talking about DFS, which we don't on the show, it's a bit of a struggle.
Yeah, it's definitely different on Tino, but it's
well, you guys are probably looking forward to AFL over there, I would imagine.
AFL 2016, 2018, yeah. Rookie league guys, yeah, it's all over the map.
Yeah, so that's that's all exciting, and I'm kind of looking forward to the season ending so I can pump out my valuations, because that gives me a lot of things to talk about retrospectively.
Yeah, that's probably my favorite thing, valuations. And it's kind of a sad day because Jung Ho Kang went down today with a knee injury. I really hope it doesn't affect him long term. I'm not going to debate whether or not the slide was clean or dirty or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's just, it stinks to see an injury like that to a guy who was having an incredible second half and was a big time fantasy asset for next year.
Yeah, it's really shitty. It just is really shitty.
Yeah, I agree. Regardless of how you feel about the slide, and you're right, it's not worth getting into one way or the other, and you're creating a debate. Not so much with us, but with our listeners, it just really stunk. And I was watching that game in between meetings today during the day. I was working from home, and that was brutal.
Yeah, I mean, how many times do you see a routine kind of slide into second base and you just take it for granted? And it stinks for the Pirates for this year and for next year, too. Yep. On that note, sorry, guys.
On that note, you can read us at baseballperspectives.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And George is at George Bissell. That's two S's and two L's. So we're going to kick off this week like we do every week. We're going to talk about expert fab bidding, although these segments keep getting shorter and shorter each time we do them because people get less and less fab. So, Mike, where do you want to start this off?
We can start labor mix. I can tell our listeners, I was half joking about this on Twitter, but I might just take random topics for the last 2 weeks and pretty much just insert them into the fab column, because this is week 24 of 26 weeks of doing this, and it's getting, I'm kind of running out of stuff to say, which if you know me, says a lot. I usually have always have something to say. So yeah, we'll start in the We'll start on labor mixed. And you know, the big buy there was, and we were talking about him a little bit before the show, was Dustin Garneau. He went for $11. He went to Rasball's Rudy Gamble. And he kind of is what he is to me. He's a catcher who's going to split time with Nick Hundley out. He's going to split time with Tom Murphy. It sounds like they're going to go right down the middle. I don't think either one of those players is particularly great, but you have the Coors factor, and I believe there's 10 games left in Coors as we're talking to you tonight. So if you're looking at five starts from a Coors catcher with even, you know, a smidgen of power in that venue, I think they're solid pickups or spec plays in a mix. And for Rudy Gamble, Rasball, you know, he had Hundley, he dropped him. So it's a pretty obvious play for him. And it's just one of those plays that makes sense, but isn't necessarily eye popping.
Yeah. It's one of those things where the $11 bid is because there was $11 left, right? I mean, how much fab did Rudy have left coming into
Rudy? Rudy had 23 left, and in addition to Garneau, and we can get into this in a moment, he spent 19 of his remaining 23 in his fab. So he pretty much decided to all but empty out what he had left.
Yeah, which makes total sense.
Sure. And, you know, Rudy is in the position, you know, we get into this too. It's a two-team race at this point. It's a race at the moment between us and the annoying, and I mean this in a complimentary way, Fred Zinke of MLB.com, who, as I speak, is 2 points behind us, which, if you've listened to us week in and week out, is pretty effing unbelievable, because we had about a 20-point lead. And we haven't lost ground so much as Fred just keeps coming at us, like Mel Gibson in The Patriot, if you want to use an analogy that maybe George remembers, maybe he doesn't. Do you remember that movie, George, or are you too young for that?
I've seen reruns on TV. Yeah, I've seen it.
He dies at the end of the movie, right?
No, he doesn't. His sons die.
Oh, shit.
I hope I didn't ruin The Patriot for the people out there who didn't see that movie from like 15 years ago. but anywho... So, yeah, Rasball right now, he's in fifth place. There's kind of a clump between third and fifth. So he's playing for third. And, you know, we've talked about this before on the show. There's if you're playing for third in an expert league that doesn't carry over, that's, you know, to me, that's the way to go. So, yeah, he was just looking to spend his money.
Yeah, it's like you said, it makes sense based on where he is. I mean, you could argue that that's probably a little too much fab to take into the last month of the season, but you know, you never know what bids, you know, he just missed out on over the course of the season. It can play different ways.
Yeah, it goes back to the questions. You know, we got Kyle Schwarber for six. I was a little surprised that no one else was a little bit more aggressive. I think we talked about that with Steve Gardner when he was on the show in one of the weeks you were out, Brett. You know, yeah. I think that was a matter of it being an odd week where it was a truncated week and some people weren't paying attention because of the All-Star break. But for the most part, you're right, it's difficult because unless I go back and call through every single one of the bids, you know, it's hard to know where Rudy or any, you know, fantasy expert for that matter might have been aggressively, say, on Miguel Sano or Carlos Correa, and maybe just missed by a couple bucks.
Yeah, and you know, I think, well, I kind of want to bring this into the opposite end of the spectrum and talk about sort of where we are, even though we didn't make any moves here. We are. I don't want to say we're kind of in trouble, but we're operating at a slight disadvantage because of the way things have broken over the last couple of weeks, because we don't have any fab left. So we have, obviously, we lost to Tulowitzki this past week, and fortunately we did have, we actually have two backup middle infielders on our roster, so we put Scooter Gennett in there. The bigger issue is that we keep dwindling starting pitching. I think we were going to plan on trying to grab as many starts as possible the rest of the way, and we lost Joe Kelly a couple of days ago, which hurts more than it probably should, just because he was our last non-starting pitcher we had.
Yeah. Well, to explain to our listeners, we had three starters that we were streaming into our seventh starting pitching slot. So we had a choice, I believe, between Jared Weaver, Joe Kelly, and Anthony DeSclafani.
Yep.
And that doesn't sound like much. And if you're in a standard mixed league, you're probably thinking, why, unless, you know, DeSclafani had a really easy matchup against, say, the Braves, why would you even consider any of those guys? But in a 15-16 team mixed, and in our position where we have a pretty fat ERA whip lead, it was a matter of playing for wins and some strikeouts and not having to worry about those categories. So now we kind of have to run Weaver out there. We have to run DeSclafani out there. It's not the end of the world, but it was kind of nice to have that option. But the other problem is that if DeSclafani gets shut down, or if we have another injury, or if somebody gets skipped, we just don't have the luxury to do anything else short of putting Carson Smith in there, who's on our reserve because he's not closing, or in the unlikely event that Adam Wainwright comes back for the last couple of weeks, and I think on Monday they're going to reevaluate that, we could stick him in, but that's just not something I'm counting on.
Mike and Brett, I want to ask you about one thing, though. You guys didn't pick him up because you don't have any fab left and you can't submit a $0 bid, but Corey Seager didn't get picked up by any of the teams that did have fab. Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, that's crazy beans. That's just absolute crazy beans at this time of year. He's he's up, he's got the pedigree, he has been on fire since he's reached the majors. He's exactly the kind of player that I would want to grab if we had fab. And if we had fab, I certainly would have thrown a dollar or two bet on him to replace Tulowitzki rather than sticking Jeanette in there. But that really, really surprised me.
Yeah, yep. I have no idea why or how that happened. I would have, and again, I understand it's September. Some of these experts are both dual baseball and football people. They're jazzed about football, but all it really takes is 20 minutes to look at a free agent list or to think, Corey Seager is probably available because you can't pick up guys mid year like you can in tout. I'm just surprised one expert didn't throw a dollar or a couple dollars on him just to stash him.
Yeah, there were 10 teams that had fab left, and none of them bid a dollar. So
yeah,
that's probably a mistake.
Yeah, it's good for us. You know, again, if you go back to either Fred or some of the people, and there aren't that many who are competitive with us, and at this point it's runs batted in, there's a couple of those teams, and just eyeballing for a second who Fred had. Fred's middle infielders, well, actually his middle infielders are pretty good. He's got D. Gordon, Carlos Correa, and Ketel Marte. And Correa is an upgrade on him. It's not a super terrific. I said Correa, I meant Seager. Seager's not a super terrific upgrade, but I think I still might have made the bid. Just again looking.
Yeah, the other thing about that is that Zinke's kind of locked up stolen bases at this point, right?
Yeah, he has.
So
he's 16 up on us and on Mike Podhorser's team. So yeah, barring some kind of catastrophe, and he has Gordon too. So barring some kind of catastrophe, he's going to win the category.
Yep,
it's going to be a tight race. Excited to see how this plays out. I mean, you kind of touched on it in the piece, but there's not much further left that Zinke can really go here, it looks like.
Yeah, the way he's scoring right now, I don't think there's a single offensive point he can grab.
Right, so it's all on the pitching end. So that's where the Joe Kelly injury actually is a real bummer.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I'm looking now. Yeah, he gained an average point this week, and that's about as high as it looks like he can go. Yeah, he's 17 home runs behind the next team. And, it's mixed, so it's not quite the same, but barring a barrage, he won't get there. He's 69. You can make your jokes Twitter. He's 69 runs behind us. He won't get there. So yeah, it's all pitching for him. And you know, he made a trade earlier this year where I think he traded Felix. And I know Felix has not been as great, but you know, Chris Sale, who he has been erratic. So, yeah, it's really a matter of these pitchers coming through for him. And really a disadvantage he has, and he has $2 of fab, so he can pick some players up, but he doesn't have any players on these teams that could possibly are going to be contending in the AL right to the very end, or possibly be in a one-game playoff to either get into the wild card or get into a divisional situation. Chasing when you're in a situation where a lot of teams have clinched already, as they have in the National League, is kind of where you're at the disadvantage.
Yeah, that's very true.
But it's close. You know, it's a 2-point lead, and you know what I'm kind of worried about is he does max out, and you know we just don't quite get there.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be a much more painful last two and a half weeks of the season to watch than we were hoping for. But
we got killed in batting average, and it's just a tough category once you get killed in it to pick up ground in.
Yep.
Yeah.
So well, that's the last conversation we're going to have about labor before it's over. Right, I think.
Well, if we're here in 13 days from now, it'll be during the last week of the season.
That's true.
Unless we skip another week,
we might. Yeah, we might just do one in an end of the season pod.
It might make more sense.
Wait a couple of days and do that, but we'll see. Suspense, lots of suspense.
It's either going to be real exciting or the most depressing show of all time. There's no middle ground really there.
Well, you are here, and you can certainly either go through the archives or ask Mao about it. I think Mao would probably be a little traumatized to talk about it. When Jose Fernandez got hurt last year,
yeah,
that was – Brett remembers. That was pretty much the worst podcast ever. I think Mao wanted to, like, you know, go to the Sears Tower and jump off of it. And I'm not really exaggerating that much. That was really, like – That was misery porn.
It was traumatizing.
Did you listen to that?
I listened to it, yeah.
Oh, God.
Yep.
Rough. It was rough.
Yeah, not fun.
Well, honestly, you know, to just before we leave this topic, you know, the other side of this is that if we do somehow finish in second, as sad as that would be, it's much more enjoyable than what happened last year. It's a different kind of tragedy, to put it that way.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't. It might be just as bad.
Yeah, it's a different kind of bad. Maybe that's. I think we have the title of the show, George.
It's a different kind of bad.
Yeah.
As the great Ricky Bobby once said, "If you ain't first, you're last."
Oh God! I hope we don't wind up like on a racetrack with Fred, you know, getting into a fist fight as our cars are all laid to waste. look at George making the cultural reference and me actually getting it. We finally come together.
Well, we found our what is it, the crossroads where we meet culturally. It's like somewhere in 2005.
Yeah, it's about right. It's Talladega Nights.
Some Wedding Crashers jokes on the way for you. Stay tuned.
Awesome.
So is there anything you want to talk about the only leagues? Anyone interesting to note there before we move on?
Well, I picked up I mentioned in Tout Wars NL that I picked up Tanner Roark, and that didn't work out so well tonight. He got hit hard by the Marlins, but I'm kind of getting to the point there where it looks pretty good for me. Coming into tonight, I had I think a 9 or 9.5 point lead. And I had the luxury of playing for wins. And Tristan Cocker of ESPN, he's at the point where he's not going to get the steal points that he needed to get, you know, barring some kind of crazy run at the end. He just doesn't have the players to do it. And if he doesn't get those points, almost everything has to go wrong for me and almost everything has to go right for him to even win by a point. So I can kind of make moves like that where I can pick up Roark and, you know, if he doesn't work out, I kind of look at it like, oh, well, you know, he hurts my ERA a little bit. I don't get the win. It's just getting to that point. I'm sure you guys have been in leagues like this where you have the lead and you can just see the path of the team behind you is next to impossible. You don't get cocky about it. I mean, I'm talking about a 9-point lead and a 5-by-5, not a 20-point lead. So it's possible. It's just very improbable at the moment.
Yeah, it's a nice feeling to have.
Yeah, the only guy I want to talk about real quick, Mike, we kind of touched on him before the show, but Justin Ruggiano, that was a move Tristan made. I don't know if it's going to have any sort of impact on the standings or anything like that at the end of the day, but I thought it was a nice strategic move, and that's maybe something that if you're out there in a league and you're still trying to win, you're in a tight race, these are the types of moves that I think are sneaky. This is an example of Tristan playing the matchups with a guy in Ruggiano who really kills lefties but doesn't do a whole lot else. So can you kind of explain for everybody out there the thought process behind that move? Because I know you talked to Tristan a little bit about it.
Well, just to correct that, though, Tristan actually had the second highest bid. He bid 5.
Oh, he didn't get him. I thought he got him. Okay.
Peter Kreutzer, I apologize if I gave you the wrong impression pre-show. Peter Kreutzer, Ask Rotoman, got him for 6. But mm-hmm. but the thought process, and I did talk to Tristan about it, he looked at the matchups. He looked at who the Dodgers were facing this week, and he saw 4 potential starts for Ruggiano with you know, as you pointed out, George, a very favorable platoon split, and he kind of looked at it like, well, you know, that's not a bad play for me to make. The other part of that play I thought was interesting, though, is he tried reserving Travis Jankowski, who he picked up for steals, and it didn't really work out. And this goes back to what I was saying before, which is, you know, Tristan, he's not going to get there in steals. You know, he has a couple this week. He's 4 steals behind the next 2 teams ahead of him that are tied. But he really needed to get 4 points, additional points in that category. The 2 teams ahead of those teams are pulling ahead. So by reserving Jankowski and picking up Ruggiano, I think what he was trying to do was make a crazy play in runs and a play at home runs. He's 9 home runs behind me to try to turn that point, you know, to get the 2-point swing. Mm-hmm. So these are the kind of moves he's making. I think Ruggiano, things are really tight for you, and only is a solid move for that platoon differential. But he's just at that point where, you know, we talked about, you know, we use this term all the time last year in labor, Brett. You know, Tristan's at the point where if he's not making Hail Marys, he's definitely throwing passes 20 yards up the field, you know, and right up the middle. If the clock keeps running, the clock keeps running.
Yeah, there's a time for that, and there's a time for that. And, you know, there's actually a home league that I'm in. It is a similar situation where I'm, you know, I'm about maybe 12, 13 points out and just trying to scramble to grab as many quick points as I can before my chances fade away. But, you know, we've talked about this the entire season. It's the tenor of the moves that you make in Fab should reflect where you are in the standings and what sort of chance you have, what sort of floor you're taking, what sort of ceiling you're taking. It all factors in. It's not just about talent. In fact, at this time of year, I would say Fab pickups are maybe 25% talent. 25% talent, 25% matchups, 50% standings.
Yeah, I and in some cases for me, it's even higher with the standings, particularly the deeper the league and the more limited the options are. And, you know, it's funny because in my home league, there's an owner who we have a rule where you can't reserve an injured player. That, you know, the DL goes away. So you can only reserve an injured player if there's absolute proof that he's out for the year, if the team states he's out for the year. So Jose Iglesias has a broken finger, a chip on his finger. I forget which it is. And the Tigers said they'd evaluate him in a couple weeks. And this owner is fighting the commissioner in this league about whether he can reserve him or not. And he's 2 points out of first. And, you know, my attitude about it is you're fighting about Jose Iglesias. Just drop him. I know you're going to lose a keep next year. He hasn't been a cheap salary, but you just can't worry about that. I mean, this is the title of the show, Flags Fly Forever. If you lose a league because you were stubborn about Jose Iglesias for 2 weeks, you've got nobody to blame but yourself.
Amen to that.
Before we leave the Fab, did you want to talk at all? I know, just because I know you like him, Brett, did you want to talk at all about Sean Nolan?
Yeah, I'll talk a little bit about Nolan just because I think it's a good foray into what I think is going to be a pretty undervalued asset in really, really deep and mono leagues next year. You know, Nolan was a guy who I liked coming out of the off season, and he was recovering from hernia surgery. He didn't really get any sort of, he wasn't healthy enough to get a chance to make the rotation, got beaten out by Kendall Graveman. So the rest is sort of history. Kind of he finally came back in early summer and pitched in AAA, and then is finally getting a shot now. I think he's the kind of guy who can succeed in Oakland as a back end starter, and you know, hopefully this extended taste of the majors at the end of this season helps him become someone who can put up, you know, $6 to $8 worth of value in AL only league next year over the course of a full season, who can probably be had for $1 in drafts. So it's for the rest of this season, I don't think he's really going to get wins. I'm honestly not sure what his matchups are the rest of the way. But he's going to be a guy to keep an eye on for 2016 as he finishes this season.
He has at the moment, he was pitching today, I think, against the White Sox. So he's actually a three-start guy. So he's home against the Rangers, at the Angels, and at Seattle, which those aren't bad in terms of the venues.
No, that's not bad.
And, you know, of course, that start against Seattle is the final day of the season. So as we know, you know, with the usual caveats with that, you know, you never know. They might shut him down or make it a bullpen game.
He hasn't pitched very much this season, though. I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't. He might be a really, really interesting two-start pitcher the very last week of the season.
Yeah, he might. That's a good point.
At LA, at Seattle, that's a pretty good.
That is. It's a Monday. It's a Monday Sunday too. So yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Brett, on Nolan, especially for next year. He's going to be a guy who you're going to be able to get really cheap, and he's going to have a big impact. Another guy who got picked up that I kind of like, who we know is definitely going to get starts here, is Rich Hill. He went for $1, and he had a really nice start his first time up. It was his first time in the big leagues in, like, I don't know, 6 years, yep. Something like that. I don't expect that every time out, but literally the Red Sox don't have anyone else. With Joe Kelly going down, they have nobody in the minors. They might have to go to a bullpen day once every 5 days over the last couple weeks here, because they literally don't have another starter they can put out there. It's really bad.
His matchups, and you know, it's funny, if we do a podcast for the season, maybe we'll talk just about this. But his matchup, this is kind of a good example. I like Hill for this year, but I like Nolan just as a raw play. But his matchups, he's at Toronto on Sunday, then he's home against the Orioles, and then he's at Cleveland, which, depending on where Cleveland is, you know, if they're still playing for something, that could be rough. If they're not, you know, it wouldn't be easy, but it might be a little bit different.
Yeah, they're tough matchups, but he's definitely going to pitch. They're not shutting him down or anything like that.
Oh, yeah, and yeah. I mean, based on how he looked and, you know, how the numbers looked, if you didn't see him, he's definitely someone to at least consider.
Yep.
Yeah, these are the times of year where one matchup can really ruin someone's value the rest of the season. I mean, I was just in a situation where I had to choose between a number of guys to drop, and I ended up, Mike, I talked to you about this. I ended up dropping AJ Burnett because he was matched up with Jake Arrieta the last time out, and he didn't get a win, and he didn't make it through six, and he's going to Coors next time he pitches. And even if the matchups are good, the damage is kind of already done. If he might not even get two more starts, depending on what Pittsburgh wants to do with their rotation. But it's super, super important. Can't overlook it. Yep. So why don't we move on to our topic of the evening? And I am going to I'm going to throw this over to Mike, because this was Mike's suggestion for a topic. So how do you want to kick this off?
Well, I'll kick it off by discussing the idea, and then we'll do what we kind of usually do with these topics, which is just do a roundtable on the players. So what I want to talk about, you know, that we always hear in fantasy the idea of buy low, sell high, and that's a whole separate topic in terms of how I feel about that. But I feel like what a lot of analysts don't do with the topic is at the end of the season look back at some of these players and say, okay, well, this was a guy that people were suggesting to, sell low on, or I'm sorry, sell high on, or buy low, and how the outcome actually played out. So I thought we'd do a little bit of a roundtable with some of these guys and take a look and see how some of these plays worked out. So, Brett, I can either start it off, or we can do the hypothetical three-sided coin flip and, just see how this goes. It's entirely up to you on how you want to play this.
We can kind of go around. However, I'll actually start here. I want to talk about someone who I think it was around early to mid May. I think we talked about some hitters who were starting off really well, whether we thought they could keep it up and how real we thought their performance was, and one of the guys who I was very supportive of was Jake Mariznick. And this one has not worked out. this is a situation where, he certainly looked the part the first 6 weeks of the year. He had the prospect pedigree. He was valuable defensively, and he just really fell off. Just looking at his stats from mid-May to now, and he has hit 207 with 6 homers and 10 stolen bases, which is not good. He also has 73 strikeouts and 7 walks, which is even worse than the numbers that I mentioned before. Oh. So I guess we'll start this off on a negative note, but Mariznick was a guy who I was kind of buying into, and that was just a bad scene. Fortunately, they weren't all. Fortunately, this was not the case with all of the players that I thought would keep it up. But this is the one I wanted to start with, just because this turned out well very differently than I thought. Mike?
I want to talk about somebody who we've talked about on the show, because, I have him in tout and he's been a big key to my success. But, Carlos Gonzalez, I think it kind of boggles the mind. But on June 1st, and I'm going to throw out this June 1st date a lot because this is kind of the end point that I kind of picked out of the hat here. On June 1st, he had 160 at-bats. He had 4 home runs. He had driven in 13. He had an on base of 296, but more importantly, he had a slugging of 331. And I think anybody who had cargo at that point, and me included, was kind of hopeful. But what I realistically was looking for from cargo at that point was to finish the year with 20 home runs. I figured if he could hit 16 home runs from June 1st until the end of the year, he'd be a success story. We all know what happened. He's tailed off a little bit the last couple weeks, and he's had a couple of minor injuries where he's been day to day. But he has 37 home runs now, and I think he's third in the National League behind Bryce Harper and Nolan Arenado. But the key to me with Cargo, and I think this is something to keep in mind, for all that he's been knocked and right over the years, and rightfully so, as being an injury prone player. He also had he had one injury, which was that weird issue with the webbing, which was just kind of in his hand, I believe, which was just kind of a freak thing. But he also had a legitimate knee injury where it was operated on. And I kind of remember this. I thought about this at the time. Carlos Beltran had a similar surgery where he had his knee or knees repaired. And the season after he did that, it took him about 6 weeks to really get on track, and he went through some struggles, although not the same degree of struggles that Cargo did. So while I didn't expect Cargo to go crazy like he did and be one of the best hitters, you know, in baseball for 2 months and just go on this ridiculous tear, I think I did expect him to have some kind of uptick and some kind of improvement. And, you know, honestly, the only kind of league you would have given up on Cargo would have been a shallow mix. But it's an example of a player for me where injuries are just kind of a complicated thing. And, you know, if you take Cargo as I did in Tao with the proposition that he's going to produce at a certain level, you just have to kind of hang on. And, you know, you might not get 37 home runs out of the guy. But, you know, to be honest, for my team, if he had finished with 20 to 25, I would have been pretty happy.
George?
Yeah, that's a good point about injuries. You just kind of never really know. And that's why I like Corey Dickerson next year. He's kind of had this weird freak injury season. He had the plantar fasciitis and then the broken ribs, and he's just hasn't been on the field. But when he's been healthy, he's actually hit well. So sticking with Colorado, I mean, that's a guy I like. But the guy I want to talk about is actually someone Houston traded away in the offseason. That's Dexter Fowler with the Cubs. You know, you split up his season, you look at what he did before the All-Star break, 369 plate appearances. He hit just .232, a .308 on base percentage, .369 slugging, 25 extra base hits. Those aren't good numbers at all, really. He's not bringing enough power to the equation there. And then only 12 stolen bases as well. So wasn't doing a whole lot, not hitting for a high average, not really getting on base. And then post the All-Star break, 257 plate appearances, hitting .288 with a .409 on base percentage, slugging .524. So he's gained 150 points in slugging percentage, and his ISO is up over 100 points to .236. He's increased his walk rate 16%, up from 10%. So Dexter Fowler's done a lot of things right, and if he's going to continue to get on base and hit the way he has, hit for power, not necessarily a ton of home runs, only 9 home runs since the All-Star break, but a lot of extra base hits. And if he's going to hit at the top of that lineup, that's a scary proposition going forward. He's going to be a guy who's a no-doubt top 20-30 outfielder, I think. And we've kind of been down on him, I feel like, for a couple of years because he's never kind of lived up to the big potential that we saw for Fowler when he was with Colorado and then with Houston. But he's been great for the Cubs this year, so I think that's one of the guys who's really stood out to me in the second half. Brett?
And one guy who I want to talk about, who I was, you know, sort of gradually buying shares of the first, you know, 4 to 6 weeks of the season as he was absolutely terrible, is Shin-Soo Choo of the Rangers. I think there is, you know, if you go back, I was trying to find a date on this where, because there's a specific moment I was thinking of where there was a particular league where I picked him up and off of the waiver wire where he'd been dropped, and that was April 28th, and since that day, he is he's hitting .274, .365, .465. With 16 homers and 4 steals, and that's certainly not vintage Shin-Soo Choo as we remember it, and that, you know, that guy's just not coming back at all. But you know, at the beginning of the year, I think we talked about him when we were talking about outfielders coming into the season, and I think he's going to end up, if he continues this hot streak the last couple weeks of the season, he's going to end up pretty close to, I think, where I was expecting at the beginning of the season, with sort of a 270-ish average, 20-ish home runs, and a bunch of runs in that lineup. And, you know, he's been hitting second for quite a while. In on-base leagues, he's even more valuable. His on-base percentage has been, I think, close to .450 over the last 4 to 6 weeks. He's someone who I think is going to be underrated heading into next year, because, you know, I think people will see the overall numbers and still continue to not be all that impressed. I think people will forget how bad of an April he had. But it's a really strong lineup in Texas, and it's going to be strong again next year. It's not wise to give up on him all that much. Mike?
No, I would agree on Chu. I'm a fan of his, you know, from that caveat that, you know, he's not going to ever be what he was, but I think to just give up on him is kind of foolish. I want to talk about Evan Longoria as another kind of positive story. Longoria is another player, you know, he certainly didn't start off as slow as Cargo did, but, you know, through his first 182 at bats, he had 5 home runs. The average was there. He's hitting 275, but the production wasn't there. And, you know, since then, he's kind of taken off. He's not going to be, you know, and this is kind of the thing with Longoria. He's one of those players I like because I always thought for years he was overvalued and kind of treated as a top-tier option when he was, you know, maybe a little bit below that. You know, I commonly saw him in AL-only leagues going for 30 or over that when he was never earning it. You know, and this year you finally have seen him going in the low 20s or a little bit lower on draft status. And, you know, as of right now, he has 19 home runs. He's hitting 269 coming into today, which, you know, is certainly not great, but Longoria's never been a big proposition in the batting average. He's just somebody I can see in draft formats in particular. I think people are going to look at those overall numbers and kind of shrug. He's the perfect player for me as someone who you kind of take a little bit later now because people aren't looking at him as a top flight option. And you kind of hope he slips, particularly with guys like Chris Bryant, you know, rightfully so, you know, having a higher profile or a higher draft or auction profile. I really like sticking guys like Longoria in, you know, a few rounds later, or a few rounds or a few dollars lower than that, if you can do so.
Yeah, the guy who stands out to me is Rougned Odor. He was sent down on May 8th. He was hitting 144 and was just terrible over the first month plus of the season. They called him back up on June 15th, and since that point in 300 plate appearances, he's hit 320 with a 566 slugging percentage. He has 36 extra base hits, including 13 home runs. I'm more interested because Ben and Craig wrote a Dynasty Dynamics piece in which they took a look at the top 5 Dynasty second basemen going forward, and he received an honorable mention, I believe, but a lot of the commenters on the piece asked why Rougned Odor wasn't included there. I wanted to kind of get your guys' takes on him because I'm not sure what to make of what he's done since he's been called back up and how to value him going forward, because I don't actually think he's a top 5 guy, but you could kind of make the case, given his age and the numbers he's put up, if he's able to do this again, he's pretty much there. But I think there's a lot of risk with him. What do you guys kind of think of him?
We recorded, Tina, we had a long conversation about Rougned Odor.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
Well, it hasn't. We haven't edited it yet.
Well, at least I'm on the right track then, I think.
Yeah, I think we talked about it. I'm completely in agreement with them that he's not at the level of the guys that were mentioned in the article. I think, you know, Odor is, and this is a point that I think Craig made really well when we were talking about it, is that he is, you kind of default to seeing a guy who's as young as him and performing as well as him now, and your brain kind of goes to, oh, if he's doing that now, what is he going to do at 23, 24, 25? But Odor is really not that guy. He doesn't project to hit for more power than he's hitting now. He's really kind of maxed out, and he is what he is at this point. I don't even know if the power that he's showing now is sustainable even at peak. I think he's more of a batting average guy. I think he's in the end, I think he's more of a 290 to 300 hitter with you know, 15 homers and a whole bunch of extra base hits. I think he's really not going to steal too many bases. He is really just terrible at it. I think he's got a, I think his stolen base percentage as a professional is below 40%, which is super bad. But I don't see him becoming an elite option at second base, like a top second baseman option. Yeah. I see him being a very solid top 10 option, but there's a big difference between being a top 10 option and then being included with the heavy hitters of the position right now.
You hit on all my points, unfortunately. I would say top 10, not top 5. And that's a great point. I'm working this year on the BP annual and actually have the Rangers and one of the teams I'm working on. And, you know, a guy I was looking at, you know, who it is a fallacy, Brett, as far as the growth of a player and the assumption that when a guy comes up when he's really young, he's just going to get better and better. There's some players who will, but there's also players who aren't going to, or they're, you know, they'll get a little better. And the guy I was thinking about who I just wrote up was Elvis Andrus, who a lot of people, when he came up, said, oh, you know, he's going to be Jose Reyes 2.0. He's going to hit for more power. You know, we're at the point with Andrus now where he's going to be 27 next year. And, you know, honestly, you know, he's got a couple more homers this year than he had in the past, but he's just not that guy. He's just not going to turn into a 15 home run player. It's just not who he is. And, you know, Odor is better than Andrus for fantasy. But I agree with you absolutely. He's just not somebody to me who I think is going to suddenly, you know, go out and double the power and start stealing bases and start doing a lot. And this is not a knock on Odor. I think he's a really solid player in real life. And, you know, someone in fantasy, unless you're in the most shallow mixed league there is, you know, you want to have everywhere. I just don't see the growth. I don't see him necessarily becoming a lot better.
Yeah, to me, he's a lot like Matt Carpenter. He's going to be a really good option. He's going to hit for a high average, but not a ton of power. So that's kind of where I see him going forward. It's kind of like that. That'd be a good comp for him, I think.
Makes sense.
Do you guys have any pitchers you want to throw? We've talked about all hitters so far. I guess I can start. One guy who I was still slow to warm on over the off season, but quickly realized the error of my ways at the beginning of the 2015 season was, you know, despite him getting absolutely lit up the last time he pitched, is Dallas Keuchel. I think, you know, looking at his stats, even after that outing against the Rangers, he's a 2.56 ERA, 1.03 WHIP. He's going to pass 200 strikeouts this year. This is a very legitimate fantasy ace for the next couple of seasons, I think. And you know, he's a guy who, you know, it was. I found it difficult to believe in him. You know, we talked a lot about coming into the season about believing sort of the short-term performance, and there is a very good reason why we were, I think, when Mike and I both were very bullish on Jacob DeGrom and very bullish on Jake Arrieta. I think some of the reasons why we were so bullish on those guys contributes to the reason why I think I overlooked Keuchel a little bit coming into the season, because it's not dominant. You don't watch Dallas Keuchel and look at his stuff and go, wow, that's a guy who is going to be a fantasy ace for my team. But the more you watch him, the more you appreciate him. And it's, you know, I think he's someone who is going to easily be a top 10 pitcher in my rankings for 2016 and could possibly sneak in. Sneak into the top 5. He probably won't make it all the way there, but he's in the conversation. Any thoughts on either Keuchel or any other pitchers?
He has an awesome beard. And he's great at home.
Well, I think Keuchel, when we did our tiered rankings, he was in the 3-star out of the 5, but he was my guy in that tier. and I pointed out about him, and I didn't certainly expect him to do this, but I pointed out about him, you know, a guy with that ground ball rate plays just about anywhere. But the thing that impressed me, and I agree with you, Brett, is that his stuff, I've watched him a few times this year. His stuff is just better than I gave him credit for. You know, I thought he was just kind of a pound the bottom of the zone guy, but who was somewhat hittable. You know, he's not a big strikeout guy, but he is difficult to hit. You know, and that's just one of those things, you know, some of like the work that Harry Pavlidis and, you know, a number of staffers are doing on DRA. You know, it's that good work where you can kind of see that with Keuchel, where, you know, it's not so much the strikeouts, which are there for him to a degree, but it's the quality of contact against him just isn't there. You can just see, you know, his last outing wasn't so good, but you see hitters have trouble squaring up. The pitcher I kind of wanted to talk about, and, you know, I don't want us to turn into a love fest of the players that we have in various leagues, is somebody that you really liked coming into the year, Brett, that I, you know, kind of was lukewarm on, and that's Anthony DeSclafani. You know, he's somebody who he got off to a good start. He struggled a little bit, but he really quietly, and I think particularly if you're in a shallow league and you don't pay attention to this kind of thing, he really quietly has picked it up in his last 9 or 10 starts. He has, I'm trying to find it here, in his last 9 starts, he in 56 innings, he has a 3.05 ERA, a 1.196 WHIP. But what really impressed me about him is he has almost a strikeout per inning. He's got 54 strikeouts in 56 innings. And he's just a pitcher. I don't think he's, you know, he's certainly never going to be an ace, but he's somebody who goes in there with pretty good stuff. And, you know, I watched his start against the Cardinals where he struck out, you know, 10 over those 6 innings. I don't know if you saw that start or not, Brett, but
yeah, I watched the whole start. He was really impressive.
Yeah, he just looks like somebody, you know, if you go back over his last 10 starts, he had one bad start against the Diamondbacks, who back in August were hitting everybody. But he just really looks like somebody who's developed over the course of the season. He seems to really have a plan when he goes up there. And, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but when he was struggling earlier in the year and I saw him, he was nibbling a little bit, which, you know, leads to trouble. Now he seems to have more trust of what he's doing, and kind of if he makes a mistake and if he gives up a long ball or a long hit, he just kind of looks at it like, well, you know, these are major league hitters. That's going to happen. And he just goes right back to his plan of attack. And I think he's somebody next year who is going to be worth considering just about anywhere. You know, he's on the Reds, and he's not in the best park. So the wind certainly might not be there, and, you know, he's going to have some, you know, issues with the long ball at home. But I definitely walked away more impressed with him than I was at the beginning of the year. And, you know, your recommendation on him, Brett, was very good.
One thing I want to point out about DeSclafani is that the one of the things which was talked about in the offseason, this shows you how quickly things can change. One of the things that was talked about in the offseason is that DeSclafani worked on a changeup in the AFL and was throwing it reasonably well, was throwing it in spring training. He started off with it as a, you know, a heavier part of his repertoire than it had been. He'd been getting swings and misses on it. And as the season has gone on, he's really moved away from the changeup and started throwing his curveball more, which has been a little bit surprising. The way, you know, looking at his Brooks Baseball page, he's struck out more guys with his curveball in September than he had in all 5 months prior, and he pretty much the changeup is going in the opposite direction. So if he can find that balance, that the right balance, which he seems to be finding a little bit now, the right balance of the 4-pitch mix, you know, about 5 if you include his 4-seamer and 2-seamer. But, you know, he's a guy who's – he's – the stuff is good enough to be a solid mid-rotation starter for a little while. You know, Mike's absolutely right. He's not going to be a guy that wins Cy Youngs, but he could throw, you know, 220 innings and give you maybe 160, 170 strikeouts and above league average ratios. And that's really valuable in a deeper league.
Yeah, DeSclafani, really good. I have two guys who I'll touch on briefly on both of them, but the first is R.A. Dickey. Before the All-Star break, he made 18 starts. He had an ERA close to 5. Since the All-Star break, he's gone 7-1 in 12 starts with a 2.98 ERA. You might think that's not great, but it's a heck of a lot better than what he was doing in the first half. 48 strikeouts, just 16 walks. He shaved nearly 2 walks per 9 off his rates. That's impressive. He's giving up fewer home runs. And sort of the narrative around him is, you know, he's not going to ever be the guy who won the Cy Young a couple of years ago. But he is throwing his knuckleball a bit harder now than he was earlier in the year. And I think that's really been the catalyst that's driven his second half turnaround. He's throwing at about 75 miles an hour, according to Brooks Baseball, in April and May. He's up around 78, 79 miles per hour in terms of average velocity. When he was, you know, pitching really well, and when he won the Cy Young, he had sort of the hard knuckler, which was, I think he was throwing it in the 80s, but this is the highest his knuckleball velocity has been in a while, and I think it's showing up in the results. So if you're going to invest in Dickey next year, I think that's the key thing to look at, is where his velocity is at with the pitch. And then the other guy really is Cole Hamels. I did a piece for Baseball Prospectus about a week and a half ago in which I looked at some of the guys who have over and underachieved based on what their actual ERA is and what their DRA, deserve run average, is. We've talked about that statistic a little bit on the show, but it's a great stat. You should go read about it, check out the leaderboards. It's brilliant. And Hamels was the biggest underachiever of any pitcher in baseball in terms of DRA through Labor Day. He had nearly a full run difference between his actual ERA, which was close to 4, and his DRA, which was actually under 3. He's posted the highest strikeout rate of his career since 2012. He's had a weird strand rate in terms of a lot of the guys who've gotten on base have come around to score. I kind of like Hamels to rebound. I think he's someone who most fantasy owners aren't going to regard as a real big ace commodity, but I think the numbers show that he's pretty much there, and if his ERA rebounds a little bit next year, he's going to be good in Texas.
I want to jump in and talk about Dickey really quick, because I think you hit on something that's extremely important, and you know, Dickey is really not going to be someone who's valued particularly highly coming into next season, and maybe that's fair, but the knuckleball velocity is a big deal. When he's been just average, his knuckleball has been in this, you know, 75, 76 mile an hour range. Back in 2012, it was consistently around 78 miles per hour. The last couple months, pretty much since the All-Star break, he's been at about 78 miles per hour again, and it's not coincidental that his performance is lined up with it.
Yep,
it's something that absolutely bears watching as we go into next year, because he's really just not going to be of interest to people, especially in keeper leagues. You could have had him for a song at the deadline in almost any league this year.
It's not pretty, but he's always ends up as a top 50 starter.
Fred tried to throw him into us in a deal that wasn't a good deal overall, and we were like, yeah, we don't even want him. Like, he's not even like deep mix worthy, which at the time was correct. And, you know, well, some of that was the staff that we had too. But yeah, the knuckler, you're absolutely right, Brett. The hard knuckler with him is such an important thing. When he's got the velocity on that, for Dickey, it makes such a difference.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else you guys want to throw up before we wrap it up?
I do not have anyone off the top of my head. I will tip my cap to Clayton Kershaw, which, you know, it seems like so ridiculous now, but he has an outside chance of putting up an ERA under two. I think he has to give up like two runs in 22 innings to do it, which sounds difficult. But the fact that he could even do it, given where he was in, at the end of May or the middle of May, is pretty amazing.
Yeah, he's been on another planet.
There's no analysis there. I just want to tip my cap, and you know, I think it's the reminder too. He just kind of goes back to what we were bringing up with, you know, slow starts or fast starts. I doubt anyone gave up on Kershaw. However, I could see a fantasy owner making decisions differently in mid-May based on what Kershaw was doing, as opposed to having faith in, you know, the fact that he'd bounce back. And that's kind of where you want to be careful with some of these things. Like, no serious owner is gonna sell Kershaw low, but I could see an owner making some decisions where it's like, well, I need to shift my pitching. I need to make some different pickups. You know, I need to be more aggressive. And this goes back to what we were talking about before, Brett, with Fab, where I think in September that's fine to do when you can see everything in front of you. I think in mid-May or even early June, you want to put the brakes on that kind of thinking and really look at your team and be like, well, wait a minute. You know, do I think Clayton Kershaw is going to put up a four the rest of the way, or do I think there's some really bad luck at work here and he's going to probably wind up with, you know, even like a 2.5 the rest of the way, and I don't really need to panic.
Yeah, it's always a good reminder.
His ERA, 2.12. His DRA, 2.17. He's just crazy good.
Yeah, he's really good. Well, you know, somebody had a chart out there, and I think it wasn't tied to our stat, but it was tied to, you know, his FIP and his XFIP and his ERA, and what, you know, it was one of those charts where the ERA was a mountain that came, you know, down to a plateau, but his FIP and his XFIP were always down there, you know, being a, you know, down at the bottom of a plateau where they basically got a little bit lower as the season went on, but have pretty much been consistent almost the whole year.
Hey, Brett, you know who has a better DRA than Kershaw?
Who?
Kyle Bearclaw. Hashtag Hell. Team Bearclaw.
Oh, my God. Always back with the Bearclaw, George.
He's really good. That's all I got.
He's fun. He's fun.
Yes.
He is fun to watch.
And we ended on a good note. See? There we go.
We did.
I like it.
So we will take a quick break and we will come right back and close things up. Back. Thank you for listening to episode 67 of Flags Fly Forever. We have been a Baseball Prospectus fantasy podcast. You have been listening to myself, Brett Sayer, Mike Gianella, and George is George Bissell. You can read all of us at baseballprospectus.com. You should go there today and check out all of our stuff. Premium membership, super premium membership, buy them all. They're all wonderful. We're about to head into the off season, where we will do a whole lot of recapping of the season and build into looking forward to next year. On a non fantasy note, we are starting the process of getting our prospect list together, which is always fun to read, and we got a lot of fun stuff coming up there. So go check it out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Email us, flagsflyforever@baseballprospectus.com. We will be back possibly before the end of the season, but possibly not. But we will be back regardless. So with that, have a good night. And hope everyone does extraordinarily well the remainder of their seasons. Goodbye.
Bye, guys.
Good luck, everybody.